From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers are trying to pick up the pieces of a deal to keep the government from shutting down this Friday, but the attention remains on those reported inflammatory comments from the president last week. It was Democratic Senator Dick Durbin who relayed the president's comments. Today in a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, he questioned Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, who was also in the meeting.
You said on Fox News that the president used strong language. What was that strong language?
Strong language. There was apologies. I don't remember specific word. What I was struck with, frankly, as I'm sure you were as well, was just the general profanity that was used in the room by almost everyone.
She would never say if the president used the words he's reported to have used, but she did agree with Durbin that Republican Senator Lindsey Graham rebuked the president for the language that he did use. So language still an issue? So is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. Many Democrats say it has to be part of the spending bill. NPR's lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, what are you thinking of the sense of whether or not they're going to come to agreement on a spending bill?
Hi, Robin. Well, it looks like they're probably likely to go and do a stopgap spending measure once again. The talk right now is that it could be as much as 4 weeks where they push off trying to negotiate on DACA for another month to keep the lights on in the government. Because, you know, without being able to negotiate this, if both sides dig in, then you would wind up with a shutdown Friday.
What do you make of this exchange? I mean, everybody wants to move on from this exchange and the language that was used in the meeting last week. What do you make of the inability of Dick Durbin to get somebody sitting in the same room with him to acknowledge that the language was used? And she did acknowledge, she was saying that Lindsey Graham used strong language, and Dick Durbin said, but he was repeating what the president said, and she acknowledged that. How much is this going to drag everybody down a rabbit hole?
Well, Durbin has said that he stands by every word that he said. And, you know, frankly, Nielsen there did not exactly deny that strong language was used and that a vulgarity could have been used. Instead, she tried to say everybody was using vulgarities. Really, the vulgarity that Trump used is not the issue. It's not that sentiment that was below that is the thing that people should be focusing on. And that sentiment is that there are people from different countries who should not be coming to the United States from certain countries, that we should be taking in people from other countries like Norway, which happens to be a whiter country than someplace like Haiti or African countries, and that the only people that should be coming to the United States is changing immigration for it to be a more merit-based system, which is traditionally not what the United States has been.
Well, taking a look at some of the other things on the plate this week, President Trump heads to Pennsylvania. He's going to promote the tax overhaul Congress passed in December, but also throw his support behind Republican Rick Saccone. He's running to replace Congressman Tim Murphy, who resigned in October after it was revealed he'd encouraged a girlfriend to get an abortion. Murphy's staunchly anti-abortion rights. So how are Republicans feeling about another special election in a conservative district after the victory of Democrat Doug Jones in Alabama?
This is a district right outside Pittsburgh with a lot of former Democrats in it, people who are still registered as Democrats but who kind of changed after the election of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s but are still on the books as Democrats. But President Trump won this district by 20 points. This should be a pretty safe seat, as you note, for Republicans. But the White House political director, Bill Stepien, is concerned about the amount of money that the Republican has raised in this race, Rick Saccone, and he hasn't raised much, and the Democrat right now is faring pretty well. He's got some backing behind him and some energy on their side. And the real issue for Republicans, and it is very odd for a president to have to expend political power and energy for a special election in a House race. And that's exactly what he's going to be doing this week by having to go to this district. Because if Democrats are able to pick off this seat, then it's going to send shockwaves throughout the entire Republican House delegation to say that no seat is safe, not even a place that should be a safe Republican seat, because Democrats have enthusiasm on their side.
Well, there's another shockwave in Missouri. Republican Governor Eric Greitens today canceled a statewide tour amid calls for his resignation over allegations that he tried to blackmail a former mistress. He's the first-term governor, former Navy SEAL. He admitted to having an affair but denies, you know, the accusations of blackmail. But he was considered to be a rising star, future presidential material. That's no longer the case.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, at this point, he's got to get beyond this if he can. There's also some talk of an ethics investigation because an attorney had called his mistress to see if she'd been talking to the media. So there's going to be a lot more to follow on the ground there in Missouri.
Yeah. Domenico Montanaro, a lot to follow for you, NPR's lead editor. Thank you.
You're welcome, as always.
Well, there's a breakthrough in the crisis involving the Rohingyas. Bangladesh and Myanmar announced today that Myanmar has agreed to accept the return of 1,500 Rohingyas each week as part of a repatriation deal. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority, and hundreds of thousands of them are living in refugee camps in Bangladesh. They fled violence in Myanmar that the U.S. and the U.N. describe as ethnic cleansing. Joining us now is the BBC's Jonathan Head. He's in Bangkok, Thailand. And Jonathan, tell us more about this agreement. What will it do?
It's the first meeting of what's called a joint working group, which Myanmar and Bangladesh have established to try to work through this problem. I think we need to take the numbers they're quoting with a pinch of salt, really. At this stage, a large-scale repatriation looks impractical simply because the ground hasn't been prepared inside Myanmar in Rakhine State. The refugees have made it clear that they will not go back, almost all of them when they're spoken to, unless there are some kind of assurances for their safety, in particular from the Myanmar military, which they accuse of the most appalling abuses. Now, the Myanmar military hasn't admitted any of those abuses. It's still the dominant authority in northern Rakhine State, where these people came from. It hasn't been held to account at all, so that's a major obstacle. The fact is that Rakhine State is still cut off from any kind of international scrutiny. Big agencies, UN agencies, are not allowed to operate except in a very, very limited way. And that means the normal kind of preparations you'd have for refugees coming back to a conflict zone where they've been chased out under terrible circumstances, none of that can really happen. We're hearing the Myanmar authorities saying that they are rebuilding. But unfortunately, the Rohingyas are not likely to trust their assurances. So while Bangladesh is saying that the Myanmar authorities are willing to take back 1,500 refugees a week, and even at those rates, it would take about 10 years to bring back all these refugees. There's about 740,000 in total. In practice, most people on the ground think those sorts of numbers aren't going to happen anytime soon.
Well, and what would the refugees be going back to? Because weren't many of the villages burned to the ground?
Yeah, the villages were utterly destroyed. Now, they could be rebuilt fairly quickly. They're mostly palm thatch and wooden structures. That's not too difficult. The much bigger challenge, I think, is re-establishing a kind of normal society there. You have to remember that for all of the mistrust and tension between the Muslim and non-Muslim communities there, they and the non-Muslims interacted a great deal. Their economies were tied together. It's a very agrarian place. There's farming, fishing, basic sort of manual jobs. And with the Rohingyas gone, the economy has sort of disintegrated, but also the local non-Muslim population have taken part in the destruction of Rohingya villages. They've joined the military, and they are very, very resentful of the idea of the Rohingyas coming back, very fearful of them, fearful of retribution. There's a huge amount of work that needs to be done to end the hatred and mistrust of Muslims that has been, frankly, partly encouraged by the state, and that needs to stop, and just to rebuild the trust of the local community before they will even accept the Rohingyas coming back. I've seen meetings that have been held with Rakhine Buddhists who live there saying, we'll never have them back, we can never live together again. With that kind of attitude, you can't be bringing thousands and thousands of refugees back.
So still a lot of questions about how this would work, but do we know why the government in Myanmar decided to agree to this deal?
Well, they're under enormous international pressure, and my guess is that they didn't perhaps fully appreciate the scale of the human catastrophe that was unleashed by the military operation last August. The civilian government doesn't have control over the military. You get the sense that Aung San Suu Kyi herself, who's decisive in this, hasn't really been properly informed. Now that it's happened, I think they recognize they do need to do something. They're under pressure also from China, very subtle pressure. China's not open about this, but at least to find a resolution. Bangladesh is rightly saying it's actually destabilizing for the southern part of its country to have these vast numbers of refugees encamped there. So it's a regional problem, not just a local one. but I don't think they're ready yet to internationalize it. And from Bangladesh's point of view, privately Bangladesh officials are extremely skeptical, but they have got Myanmar at least to admit these people must come back. Remember, the official view of Myanmar up until recently was these people are illegal immigrants, despite the fact that some of them have been there for generations. We don't want them. Good riddance. We're glad they've gone. Changing that attitude was important, and the Myanmar government does now accept they should come back, that it should be orderly, and that they should make some kind of efforts to prepare for them. So I think Bangladesh is willing to put a positive gloss on their meetings and encourage some kind of targets, even though realistically they know that getting a full-scale repatriation going is probably going to take much, much longer.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Head joining us from Bangkok, Thailand. Jonathan, thank you.
Good to talk to you, Jeremy.
As we wait to see whether President Trump is able to make a deal with Congress this week to avoid a government shutdown, what about the other possible big-ticket item on his agenda this year? That trillion-dollar plan to improve infrastructure across the U.S. that he's been talking about since the campaign. If it happens, it could be the biggest infrastructure push in the U.S. in decades, perhaps comparable to FDR's New Deal.
How big is the WPA road program? In its first 18 months of operation, the mileage end-to-end would have stretched five times around the earth.
The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, just one part of the New Deal. Gray Brecken is a geographer and founder of the online archive The Living New Deal. He joins us from Berkeley, California. Gray, first tell us more about the WPA. What did it build?
Well, it did just about everything. It built roads, sewers, water systems, airports, zoos, libraries, city halls. It's all over the country. It's just that you don't really notice it.
What are some of the examples of the things that were built during the WPA?
Well, a few would be LaGuardia Airport, for example, the San Antonio Riverwalk, San Francisco's Cow Palace. They restored the Statue of Liberty. It probably wouldn't have made it through Hurricane Sandy without the work that the WPA did. They built the visitor center and did all the landscaping on Liberty Island. They did Timberline Lodge, which is one of my favorites, up on Mount Hood in Oregon.
Well, actually, we've got a little piece of tape here of President Roosevelt there at Timberline Lodge for its dedication in 1937.
Timberline Lodge, Mount Hood National Forest. Dedicated September 28, 1937, by the President of the United States as a monument to the skill and faithful performance of workers on the rolls of the Works Progress Administration.
Now, we've been talking about the WPA. There's also the PWA, the Public Works Administration. What's the difference?
Well, they operated differently. The PWA was under Harold Ickes, who was also the Secretary of the Interior. And that was kind of trickle down. That's what we do now, what Obama's stimulus package did. The government hired contractors who then hired the workers. So the money trickles down to the workers through those companies. WPA and the Civilian Conservation Corps and other New Deal agencies paid the workers directly from the federal treasury. And that was a way of actually lifting the economy from below. We don't do that much anymore, but it actually was much more efficient for getting the economy out of the Great Depression than the PWA was.
I'm always surprised that when I, for example, drive down to Cape Cod, that I cross one of two bridges, both still standing there and both built during, in this case, the PWA, the Bourne Bridge and the Sagamore Bridge, both part of that project.
Yes, we're using it all over the country at like the Triborough Bridge in New York and the Bay Bridge in San Francisco.
And the Pasadena Freeway in California.
Yes, the Arroyo Seco Freeway. The problem is, is that they built very, very well. I'm always astounded when I look at those buildings and other structures at how well built they are. And fortunately, they did so because they never imagined that we would decide to stop maintaining them. But one of the things that the WPA did was to pave the farm-to-market roads that so many farmers depend on to get their produce to markets. And all of that is falling apart right now. And so as are our sewers and our water systems and our dams, which are many of which are not even being inspected anymore. So we've really got a long ways to catch up. But I think meanwhile, we should just become aware of what was done at that time, why they were the greatest generation who built all that stuff. And we should be grateful to them.
But that must have been a massive undertaking to employ directly so many millions of people. How did they do it?
Well, Harry Hopkins was in charge of all of that. He was a social worker, but he also was a brilliant administrator. There was a another agency in the winter of 1933 to 34, which was kind of the beta version of the WPA. It was called the Civil Works Administration. Most people never heard of it. But that was to get people through that winter. And amazingly, within less than 2 months, Harry Hopkins put more than 4 million Americans to work doing everything from paving roads and building parks and airports to painting murals. The WPA, in its 8-year existence, employed about 8.5 million people. And since the country had about 200 million fewer people at that time, well, if you employed 4 million people in less than 2 months, that would be the equivalent of about 10 million Americans put to work.
Well, and how did they figure out who was going to be good at paving roads and who was going to be good at painting murals?
They actually did a kind of evaluation of every person who came in and tried to fit them to their skills. And if they didn't have skills, then they would generally give them skills. There was much job training. They also built thousands of schools, entire college campuses. And so there was this belief that everyone should be entitled to a free quality education. So much of the public education that I took for granted, I'm 70 now, I didn't realize that that was all a legacy of the New Deal. We couldn't imagine paying the kind of tuition that college and university students have to pay now.
Now, I remember when the stimulus money was going out under President Obama in 2009, and part of that funding was aimed at investing in infrastructure. But one of the problems that they had was that they needed the projects to be shovel ready, and many projects around the country were not shovel ready. So they actually couldn't spend the money as fast as they wanted to. Was that not a problem under the WPA?
It really wasn't a problem. Well, it depends on where you were. For example, New York City got, it's estimated, about 1/7 of all the WPA funding. And that's partly because New York was the Roosevelt hometown, but it also was a very important voting bloc, and also because Robert Moses was the public works czar in New York City, and he was ready at the go when the money started coming through. So he started building stuff all over New York City, completely transformed the city. But he also made sure that there weren't any markers to give the New Deal agencies credit. It's the only city I've ever been in where I've never seen a WPA marker. And that, I think, was deliberate, because to this day, people give him credit for what should be an FDR's column. But other cities like San Francisco got ready pretty quickly, and their mayors, even if they were Republicans, were in Washington, D.C. quite a bit trying to get money from the various New Deal agencies for projects for their cities. By 1936, 37, basically the money was really flowing and the jobs were being created by the millions.
And how much money did it all cost in the end?
Well, the WPA cost about $130 billion in our money. The PWA was $72 billion, our money.
And you mean so our money like right now? That's what it would be if you were to spend it now, right?
So compare $130 billion for the WPA, which created 8.5 million jobs, with the $275 billion that Obama spent for his stimulus package, that created an estimated 640,000 jobs. So compare that with the 8.5 million that WPA created, and then multiply that by 2.5, which would be the multiplier for the increase in population now. So you can see that, in fact, this kind of trickle-down, which was the PWA and the way we work today, is not very efficient for producing jobs. It is efficient in producing giant dams and bridges and subway tunnels, but not very efficient in producing jobs.
Was there any pushback on the price tag, or did any politician around the country get up and say we shouldn't be spending all of this money on the Griffith Observatory or LaGuardia Airport?
Oh, there were many politicians who did, but particularly the newspapers, especially the Hearst newspapers. William Randolph Hearst hated it. And Roosevelt was very, very popular with the workers and the unemployed. As you might understand, he was hated by the wealthy. And that included many of the newspaper publishers, especially Hearst, who called Roosevelt more communist than the communists themselves. And that's because he instituted a genuine progressive income tax in order to pay for all of these. But even Republican mayors and governors actually liked the New Deal programs as long as jobs and money were coming into their jurisdictions, because, of course, it made them very popular, made them look good.
Well, if President Trump is listening to this as he prepares his infrastructure push, what would your advice be to him, given all of your knowledge about the WPA?
Well, I would tell President Trump to actually deliver on the promises that he made, and then some, because he promised that he would spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, and he would do that in his first 100 days. He hasn't done it yet. And the program that we've seen so far is just magical thinking. That's going to require taxes, and that will be regressive taxes paid by all of us. And that is less than half of what the American Society of Civil Engineers says is necessary, even to bring American public works up to just adequate standard, let alone to make it, as Trump said, second to none in the world. We are so far behind in deferred maintenance now that we're going to need far more than $1 trillion, and that's going to have to be paid for with progressive taxation, as the New Deal programs were. And I don't think that President Trump is willing to go there.
That's Gray Brecken, who is a geographer and founder of the online archive, The Living New Deal. Gray, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In every 10 years, the Census Bureau is charged with counting every person living in this country. The next census is scheduled for 2020. But this time around, the routine count is becoming the subject of a political fight. The Trump administration wants to put a question back in the survey that hasn't been asked since 1950. And it's a question that its critics say could influence the overall count, especially in states with large immigrant populations. From member station KUT in Austin, Saida Hassan explains.
The U.S. Department of Justice wants a new question to be added to the upcoming census. As first reported by ProPublica, the DOJ sent a letter to the Census Bureau last month asking to include a question on citizenship on the 2020 census form. The agency says that information is needed to better enforce the Voting Rights Act, specifically a section that bans racial discrimination. But the request has alarmed watchdog groups. Phil Sparks is co-director of the Census Project, a national coalition of groups that use census data.
It's just a ridiculous political statement and doesn't hold water given the facts.
Spark says introducing a citizenship question would throw a wrench into an already experimental process. The 2020 census will be the first one conducted largely online. Sparks notes that the Census Bureau already collects citizenship data through smaller surveys, and the data from this 10-year count has major implications. It determines the number of seats each state gets in the U.S. House of Representatives. It's also used to determine how to distribute billions of dollars in federal funding. Should the census introduce a question on citizenship, Spark sees a potential for undercounting minority populations.
Most census experts that I've talked to believe that it'll severely impact the participation of Latinos if it goes through, and that the Latino population will be substantially undercounted because of this action if it's taken.
But the potential for undercounting isn't new. An analysis of the 2010 census shows Latino residents were undercounted by about 775,000.
The census has always been a scary proposition for people who are poor, who are in some form disenfranchised.
Luis Zayas is the dean of the School of Social Work at the University of Texas at Austin. He says for people who don't regularly interact with the government, disclosing personal information to a census worker can feel invasive. Zayas says a key challenge in Texas is accurately counting mixed status families, those where some members, often young children, are legal U.S. residents, while their parents are not. Zayas says those children live in constant fear of incriminating their parents.
Every knock on the door is a frightening moment. Every time that their mother or their father gets home late from work unexpectedly is a time of worry. What's going to happen to them? Every time a police car pulls alongside at a stoplight, they have to worry, will they notice us and stop us and take away my mommy and daddy?
Zayas points to the recent repeal of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants disclosed their information to the federal government when they signed up for the program. Now, many fear it may be used to deport them. Zayas thinks minority residents will still fill out census forms, but they'll likely leave out a lot of information, which could lead to gaps in the data. For Here and Now, I'm Saida Hassan.
When President Trump reportedly asked, why do we need more Haitians at that meeting on immigration with lawmakers, it was a sentiment Haitians in America were already feeling. Last May, they were warned that the TPS, temporary protection status for Haitians, would only be extended for 6 months. Then in November, the Trump administration announced that the 59,000 Haitians with temporary protected status would have 20 months to leave or be subject to deportation. Now, people may be surprised to learn that the TPS is awarded to foreign nationals already in the U.S. illegally or on visas when a war or a natural disaster makes it impossible for them to return home. TPS was granted for Haitians in the U.S. after that massive 2010 earthquake that decimated the country's infrastructure, and extended for a year to include thousands who fled to the U.S. after the quake. Now that it's not being extended, Haitians have been fleeing across the border to Canada, up to 250 a day showing up at the Quebec border and walking across to be arrested by Canadian border police. We'll link you to stories. They feel welcome, but many are also shocked that an agreement between Canada and the U.S. may mean they have to turn back. Let's check in with Marjorie Villefranche, director of Maison d'Haïti, or Haiti House, in Montreal, a community center and advocacy organization. And Marjorie, this huge influx that began in the summer, were these all Haitians with TPS status?
Not all of them. Some of them were TPS. It was 50-50. Some of the Haitians were coming through the United States, but coming from other countries, from Brazil, from Chile, where they were living or where they were trying to live there. So they go through the United States. Probably they spend a month or two there and then cross to Canada.
And let's just talk a little bit about what the thinking of some of the Haitians was. We remember your Prime Minister Trudeau's famous tweet after Trump's first Muslim travel ban. Trudeau tweeted out to those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, "Canadians will welcome you regardless of your faith. Diversity is our strength. Hashtag welcome to Canada." Did you hear from a lot of Haitians that they took that to mean them?
Well, I think they took that message as a welcome message. But everyone who knows that, you know, when you arrive in Canada, you have to go through an immigration process anyway. So they knew that it wouldn't be that easy. But I think they are taking a chance, because they think the mood in Canada is probably better than in the United States, and they probably will be welcome here, or more welcome here than in the United States, actually.
By last summer, you had 250 people a day crossing that border, arriving in Canada. You tell us, what did it feel like on the receiving end when you started seeing this?
Well, we start seeing this in, I would say, at the end of the month of May. And they explained to us that they are asylum seekers, and some of them explained to us that they are afraid of what will happen to them at the end of TPS. So they are urging coming here by the moment that the border is still open and Prime Minister Trudeau is still open to their coming.
But what are they finding? I mean, you do, as you say, you have policies as well in Canada. Who can stay
Well, we don't know right now. We don't know because they have to go through the process. You know, when they arrive at the border and they ask for asylum, by the moment they ask for asylum, there is a verification of their identity. And then after that, they bring them in a shelter in Montreal. They could stay about a month. At the end of the month, they receive money to rent a house and, you know, I would say small money to help them to survive. The kids can go to school, they have a working permit, and they do have health care while waiting for the answer of the asylum.
But who gets it? Because you're quoted as saying that 50% will get refugee status, and another quarter will get some other kind of status, and then 25% of them might be deported. And we're reading that, you know, Canadian officials are frantically trying to discourage this cross-border immigration. So who might get status?
We don't know yet because they are in the process of explaining why they are asking for the asylum. The second thing will happen, some of them will be accepted as asylum seekers. The others, they will deny their demand. So after the denial, they can go on appeal. And after that, probably they will ask for humanitarian consideration at the end. But that can take 2, 3, 4 years at the end. People know that they are taking that chance, but better taking that kind of chance instead of being thrown back in Haiti.
And they're risking frostbite fingers and toes, which some have lost.
This is a risk. This is a risk, but they were at risk in the United States too. So it's like, let's try this opportunity.
Isn't there something of a catch-22 here? Because Canada and the U.S. are both part of the Safe Third Country Agreement, and this states that asylum seekers have to request refugee protection in the first safe country they arrive in. So if these Haitians go before immigration officials in Canada and are asked, why should we provide you asylum, one would think they'd have to say, because I have to leave the U.S.
I'm being deported in another country.
Right.
Yes, this is what they're going to say.
But according to the agreement, they have to go back to the U.S. because the U.S. is classified as safe under this accord.
They will not send them back in the United States. The thing is that they are going to send them back in Haiti if they send them back somewhere. The few they send back in the United States, when they arrive in the United States, they didn't have any papers to be there. I'm talking about probably not the TPS one, the others. So the situation is very peculiar. That's true, but this is what they are trying to do.
What are they telling you about the possibility of being sent back to Haiti?
Well, they don't want that at all because, you know, they left the country because the situation was difficult. The country cannot protect them. The country cannot welcome them. They have nothing to welcome them. If you see the situation of Haitian population who were working in the Dominican Republic, now they send them back in Haiti, probably 100,000 of them in a refugee camp, living hell in that refugee camp. So where should they go?
In fact, Haitian officials have said there's no way they can take in 59,000 people. They have not recovered from the earthquake. They've had a cholera outbreak.
And a hurricane, 2 hurricanes.
You just tell us more about the people that you're meeting and their children, too.
Well, a lot of children. I would say actually more than 40% of the people who arrive at Maison d'Haïti, more than 40% are below 17.
You work directly with these people, but I'm wondering, yes. And I obviously your sympathies will lie with people crossing a border frozen, and they know they're going to be arrested. And we've heard the sound so many times of Canadian officials saying, you step over that ditch, you will be arrested, and they say, fine.
Yes.
And they are arrested and go
they
to shelter.
Fine.
But do you have any sympathy for this policy in the U.S.? TPS was only supposed to apply to people who are already in the U.S. when a disaster or war breaks out in their country. In the case of Haitians, the TPS was designated and then it was extended for about a year after the earthquake that they could come.
Well, now we are talking about politics because the situation in Haiti or in any other country where people have that TPS, you know, the situation is not, you know, getting better. And all the analysis that we have shows us that we cannot send those families back in Haiti. They are not people who are not working. They are very helpful to the country. So I don't think the solution is to send them back in that situation. And we do have now a lot of migration, of group of human, you know, migrating from a country to another, looking for help, looking for security.
Mm-hmm.
We are facing a global situation.
Well, meanwhile, The Intercept reports that thousands of Canadians are writing letters calling for an end to the safe third country agreement with the U.S. And then they're also calling for more resources in Canada to process people so they're not waiting. Now that TPS is formally, officially going away, do you expect another huge wave?
Who knows? Because you know that people with the TPS, they have until May 2019 to take a decision. There is no hurry for them right now. Probably they will try to see what they can do in the United States first before, you know, thinking of crossing the border. Because those who crossed the border during the summer, they didn't know the delay they would give them, you know, to take a decision.
And they'll wait till warmer weather. That's Marjorie Villefranche, Director General of Maison d'Haïti, or Haiti House, there in Montreal, talking about the influx of Haitians from the U.S. into Canada as their temporary protected status goes away in something like 18 months now. Marjorie, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
If you're looking to buy stock in Facebook, now might be a good time. On Friday, the company's shares dropped 4.5% after it announced a major change to its news feed. CEO Mark Zuckerberg said the feed will start prioritizing meaningful interactions with friends instead of brands and professional publishers. Its stock opened 1% higher this morning after Wall Street analysts reassured investors that the move will not hurt Facebook's revenue. For a look at this and other tech news, let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. He joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And this move will mean people will see fewer posts from publishers like the New York Times or other major brands. This is part of an initiative by Zuckerberg to fix some of the problems he sees in how Facebook is used. What's his aim?
Well, so as far as he stated, the aim is to effectively make people happier. And he said that based on a study Facebook conducted, when they saw people who interacted with posts where other people had commented, they were generally happier than when people just were scrolling through their feed and just glancing at news items here and there. So at least that's what they say. That's their stated claim for it.
Is there a real fear that this could hurt Facebook's revenue?
Yes, because Facebook had been running out of, you know, what we call ad inventory, basically places to put ads. Newsfeed, the more stuff that's shared, the more stuff that flows through your newsfeed, the more places to put ads. The fewer things, there are fewer places to put ads. So it actually can hurt or will hurt likely their revenue in the near term. Of course, over time, it'll just probably bring back up and people aren't necessarily leaving Facebook either. So it's a short-term hit.
How much does this change, though, have to do with all the criticism Facebook has gotten for what happened during the election and Russian hacking and maybe just not wanting to be so news focused?
It has everything to do with that. I mean, it's the elephant in the room that Facebook hasn't really cited. As I said earlier, they're citing the study. Interestingly enough, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook in general had earlier stated that, you know what, the fake news and Russia interfering has certainly affected both Facebook's community and, of course, politics at large. So it's there, and they've sort of tacitly acknowledged it. And I think that's the really underlying reason for all this. Of course, they haven't quite come out and said it yet for this particular newsfeed change, but that sort of seems to underpin a big part of the general criticism that Facebook has dealt with lately.
Another story I want to ask you about is Bitcoin. It plunged 20% to a six-week low after fears that South Korea and China may crack down on cryptocurrency. Tell us more about what's going on there.
Well, again, it's the whole conceit of Bitcoin is that it's currency that's not determined by fiat or determined by any central organizing body like a government. So it's sort of interesting to me that or it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that these central governments or these governments in play have sort of said, you know what, we don't like this trading against Bitcoin, so we're going to sort of put an end to it. I don't think It should be a surprise to anyone who sort of initially bought into the idea of Bitcoin. The thing is, Bitcoin has become what we call a store of value as opposed to a currency, meaning it's more like virtual gold as opposed to something you use to buy and sell things. So until it becomes something that you use to buy and sell things, you're going to continue to see these sort of big fluctuations like this.
But at the same time, and we should say Bitcoin is still over $11,000 today, so it's still high relative to where it has been over the last year or so. But there are some who still think it's going to go up to $100,000.
Or it could go to zero.
Right. Right?
I mean, here's the thing. Again, there's no fundamentals to this this asset. So it really could go up or down. It's like spinning a roulette wheel. So effectively, it's the same thing. Again, the other context we should keep in mind is that we're all talking about it in terms of U.S. dollars, right? So again, we're thinking of Bitcoin relative to another currency, the one that still is sort of more widely circulated and more valued ultimately.
And by the way, losing value compared to other currencies right now, the dollar is. One more thing we have to ask you about, which is Google's Arts and Culture app. Over the weekend, a lot of people noticed a feature where the app matches your photo, your selfie photo, with faces in works of fine art. Tell us more about this and why it's taken off so much over the weekend.
I mean, it's anybody's guess, but you know, my stab at it is, you know, first of all, it's just fun. It's visual. It's a quick and easy thing. It's also personal, since it's about selfies as well. So these sort of, you know, all these things put together, certainly it sort of compounds itself and makes it a viral thing. Sort of the thing underlying this, though, what Google's really trying to do here is show off its artificial intelligence software. And I think that's the real boon here, right? I think, you know, in the near future, artificial intelligence will sort of drive so many more things sort of as an everyday part of life. And I think this is sort of one of the first forays of, like, here's how powerful this thing can be. Right now, it's sort of fun and easy, but it presages a much bigger thing on the horizon.
I tried it, and it just sort of matched me up with any photo, any old painting that had a man with a red beard. That's basically as far as it got.
It didn't work so great for me. I don't know if that has to do with Asian faces or because there aren't enough historical sort of paintings with Asian faces. But I think, again, over time, as there's more sort of a deeper library of stuff, things like sort of this AI-driven thing will become more popular.
That's Ed Lee, Managing Editor at Recode. Ed, thanks so much.
Anytime.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And you are the Van Gogh self-portrait. I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.